Medon overstates and overhears. Meanwhile, the crew that took Telemachus to Pylos and back had rowed their ship around the north shore and put in at Ithaca's chief harbour. Piraeus sent the messenger Medon to Penelope to let her know that her son had landed safely back in Ithaca, but had chosen to go straight to the house of Eumaeus. And whom should Medon encounter on his way to the palace but Eumaeus himself, who was also intending to bring word of Telemachus's return to Penelope. Medon fancied himself as something of an official court herald in training, and delivered the news of Telemachus's return, before Eumaeus could stop him, in a voice that rang around the upper chambers of the palace. Every handmaiden heard. Some of those handmaidens were enjoying very special relationships with certain of the suitors, and they quickly passed the news on to them. An urgent meeting of the suitors was called.
"Damn it," said Eurymachus to Antinous. "You had three ships waiting to surprise him. How the hell did he get past you all?"
"Must have gone the long way round," said Antinous, who had been in command of the flotilla. "We had a clear view of the channel. He never took it."
"The nasty, suspicious-minded little sod."
"I think we're going to have to deal with that boy. I believe he's dangerous. The people are beginning to respond to him. They talk about him as a future king. The way he managed to slip out of Ithaca and return without our knowledge tells us that he is no fool. I think an accident in the countryside somewhere, don't you?"
"We can divide up his property between us."
There was a murmur of approval. Eurymachus smiled a wicked smile.
"For an extra portion of the estate, I'd be perfectly happy to do the deed myself."
Medon may have been a little pompous when discharging the duties of a herald in what he believed to be the proper style, but he was devotedly loyal to Penelope and Telemachus. He had seen the gathering of the suitors, smelt a rat, and secreted himself in an alcove, from where he overheard every word of their plotting. Eumaeus had by now returned to his piggery. The only person Medon felt he could report to, therefore, was the queen herself. It was rare for Penelope to appear downstairs these days, but this intelligence of Medon's pricked her into action. With female attendants on either side and a veil over her face, she addressed the suitors in a voice that steadily rose in anger. "How dare you threaten the life of my son? Have none of you the slightest sense of shame? The boy is barely grown up, and you plot to kill him. It isn't enough that you despoil my husband's kingdom. It isn't enough that you insult my servants and companions. It isn't enough that every day you besiege me with your repellent overtures. 100 of you and none but a lone woman and a fatherless boy to defend the honour of this house. Now you coldly plan to kill that boy? The gods will punish you all." Eurymachus opened his eyes wide in astonishment.
"My dear lady, I have no idea who has been talking to you, but they could not be more wrong. For myself, and I'm sure I speak for us all, I am as fond of young Telemachus as could be. I could not love him more if he were my own son. I assure you, he's in no danger from us."
Of course, what he meant in his heart was, "The sooner I put that loathsome little brat to the sword, the better for us all." There was nothing more Penelope could say. She gathered her gown, turned, in what she hoped was a marked manner, and swept up the staircase to be alone with thoughts of her dead husband. Her dead husband, meanwhile, was back in his beggar's habit, and preparing supper with their son. Athena had done her work and once more had aged Odysseus's skin, stooped his frame and greyed his hair. Eumaeus returned from town and broke the news to Telemachus that Antinous and his men had returned from lying in ambush at sea and had rejoined with Eurymachus and the others. He did not notice his guest, the old beggar, wink at Telemachus and nudge him half off his stool.